Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Let me start off with a story from long ago, from probably over 1,000 years ago, in the golden age of Zen in China, maybe in the 8th century. And I think many of you have probably know this story. So it seems that a man was traveling from his own village to go to another village, and he had to pass through a forest. And as he was walking through the forest, he noticed there was a tiger looking out at him from the underbrush. And so the man started to walk a little faster, and he heard the tiger come out and start to chase him. So he ran for his life, and he came to the edge of a very steep cliff. He grabbed onto a vine that was hanging and climbed down over the cliff onto a ledge just about when the tiger was catching up to him. So he was hanging over the side of the cliff, holding onto the vine, the tiger pacing around above him, and he looked down to see another tiger waiting down below. And just then, a little mouse came out from a crack in the cliff above him and began to chew on the very vine that he was holding onto. And just at that moment, the man noticed a patch of wild strawberries growing from a clump of earth near where he was hanging on for life. He reached out and he picked a strawberry. It was fat and plump, and it was perfectly ripe, and it was warmed by the sunshine. He put it in his mouth and he said, "How delicious." So the purpose of Zen stories like this one is to wake us up. There are many stories like this one. They're intended to wake us up to the very fundamental truth of our lives, the truth that we very often, and mostly the truth that we overlook, the truth that we keep out of reach because of a distracted mind. And that truth is, that obscured truth is very simple. Life cannot be more perfect than it is in the present moment. And that is the message of this story. So when you, in the morning, when you are in Zazen, and you hear the voice of a bird entering your quiet mind, the bird's voice is actually entering your heart. That bird song is being given to you in the present moment, and it is perfect. In that moment, wouldn't it be foolish of you to think, "Gee, I wish it was a different bird"? So when you hear that bird, and when you accept that bird song without thinking, you will feel the power of your practice. In our practice, life is perfect in each moment. And this is true even at the times when you don't feel so. Even when you feel you are surrounded by problems and difficulties that don't feel you'll ever overcome. Even when you feel there are tigers all around you. So sometimes in our life, we will feel very good when things are going well, and we will feel encouraged and optimistic. But sometimes when things aren't going so well, we don't feel so good. But despite how we may feel personally, life itself is perfect. Each present moment includes everything, and there is no separation. There is no room in our lives for imperfection. And when you practice, when you consistently practice Zazen, you will feel this truth. We're all aware that our daily life can be very complex and very difficult, very challenging. And this was true in ancient times, in 8th century China and before. And of course, the difficulty and the complexity of life is very keenly felt today. So actually, most moments do not feel perfect. This is because we are unconsciously pursuing personal ideas of the meaning of perfection. We are holding up an image of what is supposed to be an ideal moment. And this image may include our comfort, love, safety, wealth, excitement, status. These are the things that human beings yearn for and what people strive for. But the difficulty is that with our striving, we will overlook our inherent perfection. So if you feel that one of these elements is missing, you will feel that the moment is not perfect. But it is not so. The moment itself is perfect, despite what we may feel is missing. So we have come to our practice, we have come to our spiritual practice out of uncertainty. We are feeling not entirely in tune with life. We might say we feel out of sync with something. But we cannot put our finger on the truth of our life. And so we feel dissatisfaction. Most people respond to that feeling of dissatisfaction by spending their time striving to gain things, to collect things, with the idea that collecting these things, we will find our satisfaction and fill our empty feeling. But the point of our practice, what we discover in Zen practice, is that we must go beyond striving. It's important to reorient our life and to go beyond a feeling of separation. The truth of our life is that there is no need to strive. We already have everything we need. When we can put an end to striving, we will feel a sense of oneness. Over the last few years, through the turmoil of our political process, the United States has come to recognize that millions of Americans don't feel part of anything they can trust. They feel no one is looking out for them, and they don't feel connected with the larger whole in a social and spiritual sense. And when we do not feel connected with everything, we feel anxious. It creates anxiety. And that's when we start to create ideas about perfection and not perfection, and ideas about life and death. This mental activity has us longing for perfection and clinging to life. And it causes us to reject or ignore the so-called not perfect and to have fear of death. And the problem is we do not understand that these are just ideas created out of anxious feelings. Our practice enables us to understand that these are just ideas. So the point of our practice is to recognize our inherent oneness, our inherent unity, which is the same thing as saying to express our true nature, which is non-dualistic and where there is no separation. So we are taught in our practice, and we make a great emphasis to stay mindful in each moment, to let the activity of each moment exist fully, totally, completely, with our full involvement and without ideas of it being perfect or not perfect, just totally involved. When we see a flower in the midst of its bloom, we may say, oh, isn't it perfect? But when the flower starts to age and turn brown, is it less perfect? And when it finally ages and falls, and then does it become not perfect? The flower is always perfect. The flower is always the flower completely in each moment. The green and colorful flower is the flower. The brown and decaying flower is the flower. And the flower that has fallen is the flower. When the flower is thriving as a plant, we say, this is life. When the flower has decayed and on the ground, we say, death. But the flower is still the flower. So we don't need to worry about birth and death. These are just ideas. These are just different names that we give to the present moment. There is no separation between life and death. This present moment is life. And this present moment is death, independent of what we may call it. So the present moment is completely and inherently nameless. It is complete in itself. And it includes everything. It includes both perfect and not perfect things. And this inclusion is why we call it perfect. Talking about it in this way is pretty easy, actually. It's like discussing philosophy or theory in some class or workshop. But we cannot appreciate the truth of this moment by talking. We have to practice continuously. We have to continue our Zazen practice continuously. Then we can have this feeling and then we can feel the subtle wisdom of it. So in our practice, we let our busy minds come to rest and let our body and mind feel oneness. Then we can understand the meaning of the perfect moment and the perfect life, because we have let go of ideas of perfect and not perfect, and we recognize the sameness of life and death. We will always have difficulties in our life. There will always be tigers all around us. And this is the nature of being alive. We struggle to survive. We struggle to enable life to continue. But it does not mean we have to suffer. We will not suffer when we know the meaning of struggle, and when we know the relationship of our struggle to our daily life. So even though we may have difficulties, even very serious difficulties, it does not mean that life is not perfect. We suffer when we struggle against struggle. And we will do that when we think that struggling itself is not perfect. When we do not see that life is death and death is life, just different names. We will have to struggle always while we are alive. We are always born and we are always dying. Life is the continuous occurrence of struggle, the continuous occurrence of birth and death, moment by moment. And that is why life is perfect in its activity. So, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to engage with you and discuss whatever is on your mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Les. So if anyone has a question, just come to Gassho or you can raise your hand. Lee.
I just wanted to say this talk is, it's very moving. Some years ago, I think it was even before I came to this practice, I had to have a lot of dental work done, some wisdom teeth being pulled and stuff like that. And somebody told me, you know, about this thing to do when you have to go through something painful, and they said, when you breathe in and you say goodbye, and you breathe out and you say thank you. And so it's so strange that stayed with me when I came to meditation too, just sometimes thinking, you know, oh, the breath is coming in and then thank you, goodbye, you know, this kind of feeling. And that's what your talk brought to mind. For me about that meditation, and just that we're always taking in and we're always letting go and saying thank you for this moment, thank you for this beautiful moment. And it's just, that's part of why our meditation is so effective, I think, over time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee.
I'll ask a question.
I
don't know if I have it perfectly formulated, but I couldn't help but notice while you were speaking that right over your shoulder is Suzuki Roshi, right as you're speaking about life and death. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, someone like Suzuki Roshi, your teacher, who is obviously a very inspiring individual, and kind of unfair how you had such little time with him, but just wondering, how do you stay connected or maintain that feeling of connection to the people that you've loved that have physically passed on?
Those people who were significant to me when I was searching or seeking or studying, those people who I encountered, who made an impression, they are indelible in my mind. I don't need to make an effort, actually. They're always there. And they always pop up at certain times without my even trying. And that's a good point that you raise, that we do have certain, if we're fortunate, there will be particular people in our lives who will touch us by expressing the qualities that we admire and that we hunger for. And when we meet them and they touch us at a very deep place, we never forget them. We never forget them. We are never separated from them once we make that connection. And it would take, really takes no effort to keep them in our minds and heart. Thank you.
Thank you. Craig.
Thank you. Thanks, Les, for your talk. I wanted to share one thought in response, and then I also had a question. The thought that I wanted to share was with regards to the part from the beginning of your talk where you said, when we're sitting zazen in the morning, when you hear the bird singing, it enters your mind and it enters your heart, and the bird and the moment are perfect. And it made me think of last week's talk, and it made me think about how Diane is the bird, and Umar is the bird, and Lee is the bird, and Bunny is the bird, and we're all each other's birds, and we enter each other's lives and each other's hearts, and it's perfect. And I really appreciate that about this group. That was my thought. My question was about the flower, or more about myself. And you said that when the flower is alive, it is the flower. And when the flower is dead, it is the flower. And so my question is, when I am alive, am I myself? And when I am dead, am I myself?
You are yourself, and at the same time, you are much more than yourself. This is what we learn when we pay very careful attention to our life and how we are in the world and how we are with everything else in the world. I am me, but at the same time, I am more than me. I'm not separated from all the others. This is the paradox of our practice. The paradox that says there is no separation between you and everything else. But of course, we feel separate. And this is the question that all of us ponder. If the teaching tells us there's no separation, why is that? Why is it I'm always feeling separate? And this is the enigma that we pursue with our practice. No easy answer. Sorry. Thank you.
Giuseppe and then me.
Giuseppe.
Where's Giuseppe? Oh, we have two pages of people. There we go. Giuseppe, there you are. Yeah, I see you.
I can start the video, but you won't see much of me because I'm in the dark.
I saw you for a second, then you disappeared.
I don't know why, but I'm in the dark. So, sorry for that. In 20 minutes, it will be light. But my question is on the sentence from Suzuki Roshi that we quote a lot, and we quote, and I quote, and sometimes too casually, that. As we are, but we could use a little improvement. And I started being annoyed with that quoting that sentence so often. And I feel that I think as students, we end up putting the emphasis on the second part of the sentence, that we can use some improvement. And there is the little laugh that goes with it. You know, it's like, haha. And so I've appreciated your talk, talking of the first part, which is not mitigated by the second part in any form. And so is that we're perfect as we are. So my question is, in our practice, don't we end up, how is that we end up too often to put emphasis on the improvement part, using a little bit of improvement, rather than focusing on the we are perfect as we are part? Probably a tendency of our mind, I suggest, but I would like to hear from you, because there is a quality of our practice also, of attention that becomes striving for perfection or for improvement. We heard Diane on this topic last week very, very thoroughly. How do we recenter our practice on we are perfect as we are? That is my question. And I have a side consideration, which is you talked about life and death, and we think of we can't really think of our entire experience, really all the good, all the bad, now and in the future, which will include our death. We don't really comprehend all that at the same time in our mind. It seems very difficult. But if we do, of course, it all evens out. You know, you get some good and you get some bad from the point or our personal point of view, Santiago. So is it also this type of view that you are talking about that makes a larger view? So that was a side comment I wanted to share, but I would like to hear your answer on focusing on the perfection, perfect as we are, and how we can work on that in our practice.
When we are, quite serious about our practice, and by that I mean when we want our practice to help us make our life as complete and as authentic as possible. When we are serious about our practice, we make an effort that reflects our perfection. But if we get casual about our practice, we won't make such an effort to try to express our perfection. So because we want to be complete and authentic and not compromised, we keep our attention on the things that we do so that we don't trip up and betray our perfection. So we will notice the little imperfect things we do from time to time, which is where we can stand some improvement. I think Suzuki Roshi was trying to encourage us to pay attention, to continually try to improve ourselves, to go beyond those things of our mind that distract us from who we are. When he says you can use some improvement, he's saying you must continually come back to yourself. And don't get lost in your distractions. Because we get distracted, because you get distracted, you're going to need some improvement. Come back and pay attention. Come back and be mindful as best you can in each moment. And when you make this effort to be as attentive and as mindful and as heartfelt in each moment, we express our perfection. And because it is difficult to do that, we have to try. We have to improve the way we do it. So it is a clever saying, and it is very humorous, but it's quite serious. We are perfect as we are, yet we need to continually make an effort to keep that perfection, to keep expressing that perfection, to keep expressing our true self. What would if his saying was simply, "You are perfect just as you are," I don't think that would be very helpful. But he goes on to say, you know, you have to continually make an effort. So he's challenging us and admonishing us and encouraging us to continually make the effort to express our true self. And it's wonderful that his quote, his saying, is so full of humor. It means we'll never forget it. We'll always reflect on it. We'll always share it, like we're doing now. It'll always be with us. The humor he brought to his teaching was part of his great gift. So, you know, even in this moment, when I feel maybe I have one more thing to say to answer your question, I want to make sure I get it right. So I pay attention to what's formulating in my mind and how my words are formulating. This is how I try to always improve myself. Thank you, Giuseppe. Are you in the light yet?
You can see the light behind me. The sun is slightly coming up exactly behind me.
Oh.
When I spotlight you, then you go dark, Giuseppe. But when I keep it on, when I don't spotlight you, then the light from your screen makes us see your face a little bit. So you can use.
And
your
then screen. You don't see the light behind me.
Oh, no. It's a little blue. I have pretty good.
Yes.
A little blue.
That little blue is the light that is coming up from the sun.
Is it 5 a.m.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 5 a.m.
Are you outdoors or are you inside by a window?
No, I'm outdoors because I'm not at home and I don't want to disturb. I don't have space in the house to hear and talk.
Mm-hmm. Good.
But it's great to see you all. Yes.
Yeah.
Next, we have Megan.
Did I mute myself? I did.
Yeah, we can
hear you. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. It seems to me like there's a difference between life and death, although you're saying there isn't. Maybe that's just part of the confusion, but like death seems like a loss, you know. If, say, someone that I care about dies, then that's a loss. It's not, it doesn't seem the same, birth and death. I mean, or life and death. And maybe you could say more about that.
Yes, of course, there will be a loss and grief when somebody we care for passes away. But how we feel, the grief we feel, the loss we feel, doesn't mean it's a negative thing. It's just how we feel. And someday, when the grief passes, and we won't feel so bad, we will remember that person and say, "She was quite wonderful. She was perfect." But, you know, we are humans and we do have emotions and they do give us pain when we lose somebody like that. So in the moment when somebody passes away, it doesn't feel perfect at all. But it is the way it has to be. It is the way it has to be. We are born, we appear from nothing, and that's the way it has to be. We have to appear. And then later, we have to disappear. That's the way it is. It's the way it has to be. And our role is to continue that. And along the way, our human feelings will come up. There's a question that we can explore sometime, and that is, how do we keep our equanimity in the face of loss or in the face of pain? I think we'll save that one for another time.
Okay. Well, I would like to hear more about that.
Yes. Okay, maybe another time. Let's think about it.
Mm-hmm. Plus one.
Oh, hi, Doug.
I was just saying plus one.
Plus one?
Yeah.
That's okay. That's nerd speak for I would like to hear about that as well. Yeah.
Oh, plus one. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular nerd speak dictionary or lexicon?
Yes, it's called my brain. Yeah, okay. I am a nerd. Therefore, I can translate from nerd. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Hey, you're welcome.
You're a bridge between the laity and the abbot. Thank you.
It was the first
plus one.
I could think of it. Plus one. Yeah.
Can I use that?
Yes, please.
Plus one.
We should do that at board meetings when we vote. Plus one.
Information wants to be free.
Okay, I'll use it with my family tomorrow. See what happens. Thank you.
You're going to be the hippest one in the room.
Okay. Good.
Teresa.
Hi, Les. Thank you for your talk.
Hi, Teresa.
I have a question. You were talking about striving and effort. Sometimes I think about effort and living effortlessly. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. It seems to me that we don't have to strive, but we have to make an effort.
Sure.
And then is there such a thing as too much of an effort?
Too much of an effort.
Or too much effort.
I think our body and mind will recognize when it cannot make any more of an effort than it has been making. You know, if I have a flat tire on my car and I want to change it and I try to take the lugs off the wheel and I can't do it, it's too tight, making a big effort, at some point I say, that's enough. To go beyond trying to do what I cannot do, that's too much. So we should recognize our limits and do what we can do and not make ourselves anxious or create suffering by trying to do what we cannot do. So it's being honest with ourselves, honest with our capabilities and our limits, and don't try to overdo it if it's causing pain. It's okay to stop when something is beyond what we can do. So, I think our body and mind knows when we are approaching the limit of too much. Of course, we should always do enough. Thank you. Oh, by the way, Teresa, your car is gone.
Oh, good. good news.
Yeah.
Thank you.
May?
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you. I've been thinking about that word for a while, about strive and effort. Well, English is not my native language, but I feel like I'm becoming a linguist at this moment right now. Just feel like strive is just something like there's action there, and then there's effort seems really neutral. Very neutral. No aim, no goal. Aimless. But strive feel like there's some attachment, right? Or there's some expectation associated with this word. I don't know. I'm asking everyone. It's or if this understanding is correct, or you know, strive associated with attachment, either expectation or anything else, which means leads to more clinging and then and the stickiness. But effort seems really detached. Okay. Still, I think we should pay more effort and not strive. Does it make sense? It just something came up my thought. Thank you.
Well, May, about 2 weeks ago, you wrote about your experience washing the dishes at the Kanando.
Yeah.
And how good it made you feel.
Effortless.
Remember that? I remember that.
Yeah.
And it made you feel so good just to take care of those things.
Because I don't have goal.
Yes, there was no... If somebody were to ask you, what is your goal? You could say, well, that is not a relevant question. But you made the effort to wash those dishes and to help everybody else. But I don't have the sense that you were striving to accomplish something. You just did it without attachment because it gave you joy. That's all. And, you know, if we can do everything with the same attitude that you did those dishes, there'd be no confusion. And that is how we hope to be, to do everything, all of our actions and all of our relationships, to do them so smoothly and naturally without striving, because it's joyful to do it. It's easy with the dishes because they don't have much of a personality, you know. It does start to get tricky when we're with another person.
Well, I think a dish does have a personality. Okay. It's a very cute mug.
Cute.
Yes, I got you. Thank you.
Okay. But a dish doesn't say, oh, hey, May, you didn't dry me enough.
Yeah.
Thank you. I came across a saying in the Dhammapada that I think most of you know about. Let's close with this. It says, so let us live happily, totally detached, freeing ourselves from the anxiety of losing all that is ours. Totally detached, freeing ourselves from anxiety. Does anybody else have a question?
Good. Vanessa?
Not so much a question, but I was just curious. I was thinking about the word perfect and perfection. It's something that I think about a lot, and I kind of worry about how it can become something that you're like we've discussed tonight. It can become something that we become enslaved to, sort of. The more common idea of perfectionism rather than, I think the word that I prefer often is wholeness, you know, like thinking about wholeness and completion rather than perfection, which has these kind of sometimes even ascetic connotations or a connotation of something being polished. But I was curious just now when you were talking and I about the word perfect, because I think it does have so much nuance to it. And I looked up that it comes from the Latin perfectus, that comes from a verb perficere in Latin or Italian, which per meaning through, and facere is the verb to do, or so through or completely. So the original meaning would be to do, to see through completely, to do something completely. Mm. Which for me kind of draws a full circle back to this much, much warmer idea of wholeness rather than kind of that sort of more frightening idea of lawlessness, if that makes sense.
Lawlessness?
Flawlessness.
Oh, flawlessness, okay.
Does anyone else have a question? Oh, Giuseppe, you want to say something?
Yes. I have a question, Les. Do you think that our practice today, you know, in our society, attracts people that have a keen sense for perfection, not only in the wholeness sense, but also just in terms of making a struggle to self-improvement and not being a little bit more relaxed with themselves or accepting of themselves or even just confident in themselves. I surely think I belong to that category, but I was wondering, you've seen so many students, do you think there is a little bit of a bias, maybe because of our forms or something, that people of one kind are attracted? I've met some very simple people, that seems to be very relaxed about what they do, attentive but relaxed, and maybe they wouldn't have the drive to come sit, and then they would need to find another way of learning about the Buddha's teachings. So just your comment on this.
I think people are will feel attracted to the practice because it promises to them completeness, as Vanessa says. To fill up what feels incomplete. and to feel in tune. We come to the practice because we don't feel complete, because we are out of touch with something that we should be in touch with. So how very successful we are in life, or how much intelligence we may have, or how much energy we have, or creativity. It could be very high, it could be very modest. Everyone is always at risk of feeling this incompleteness, this out of tune. Everyone can feel that way. And it's necessary, you know, to take a break from all that striving of our everyday life and return to the fundamental Buddhist practice of leaving home, home leaving for a short time. Take a break, go on the cushion, go into nature, go to the monastery. Put aside for a time the part of our life that pushes us to strive and to gain. Get away from that so we can see our entire being. Then we can go back to that striving part of our life with a greater sense of wholeness and a better understanding of what kind of effort we should make. Thanks, Giuseppe. Happy to see you.
Thank you, Les. Happy to see you.
Oh, you're in the light.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.